Well, weather's a little cooler. We're grateful for that. Under the general heading of hysteria, two distinct conditions are obvious. There is a difference between hysteria and an hysterical situation. People are hysterical very often as a result of stress, nervousness, tension, or some sudden emergency arising in their lives. Very often, the ground for it is an essentially hypersensitive nervous temperament. And everyone who has a nervous temperament should go to work on this a little, just to be on the safe side. How do we know whether we are nervous or not? One of the simplest ways, of course, is to study the irritation level of the individual. What does it take to bother you? How far can you stand certain pressures or stress without reacting in some kind of a semi-irrational way? Are you able to hold your temper well? Or does it come to a point where an explosion is almost inevitable? One of the most common problems is to find out whether other people can disagree with you on almost any subject without causing irritation to you. A calm, placid temperament is much less inclined to develop various types of psychic stress. If you have an agitated temperament, or a temperament that agitates quickly and easily, you should consider the effect of this upon the immediate environment. In this case, the immediate environment is your own health. Wherever stress arises in the personality, rates of vibration are set up that disturb normal functions. An individual who is extremely nervous develops a series of ailments which result from lack of nerve control. The more nervous we are, the more likely we are to have at least minor physical complications that are distressing and uncomfortable. We know, for example, that tension affects elimination. It affects digestion, and it very much affects sleep patterns. Wherever the person is essentially tense, one of the symptoms is an occasional hysterical outburst. Some feel that this is a very necessary and useful means of letting off steam. But thoughtfulness indicates that it is better to keep the steam low all the time than take a chance that it may burst the boiler on certain occasions. In order to be really in control of yourself, you must be able to meet unusual circumstances with comparative relaxation. I know a case of a very well-equipped executive secretary. This particular secretary was well integrated, very matter-of-fact, impersonal, self-contained, and apparently the very embodiment of detached efficiency. One day, however, the secretary made a kind of curious mistake. There was a large filing cabinet, and the secretary made the mistake of opening the two or three upper drawers too far. The result is that the filing cabinet started to tip over. It lost its balance point. The secretary managed to get it back on its proper basis, but had a practical nervous breakdown as a result of the incident. They had to go home and remain home 2 or 3 days to get over it. Now, it probably wasn't so much the tipping of the filing cabinet as it was the sudden realization that this matter-of-fact, purely business attitude, which had been carefully cultivated, would not hold in even a small emergency. Behind it was again the pressure of a natural tendency to emotional distress. So we watch people as they go along through life, and we find that certain persons apparently have to have periods of emotional or hysterical intensity. They seem to require the shock of letting off from themselves a static kind of electricity which threatens to become a serious issue. Most of this type of hysterical reaction, however, is not a genuine ailment. It is simply the result of habit. It is the result of personal intensity. It may be as the result of a certain frustration of a desire at a moment. And all kinds of minor tensions can cause moments of hysteria or hysterical reactions. These sometimes develop in children, where a child discovers that a tantrum produces the desired result. The tantrum is very apt to become habitual. If a person has tantrums in their teens or even earlier, they generally make a very important discovery. Other people do not like to be made uncomfortable by the disposition of an emotionally stressful person. Anyway, they will do what they can to prevent the stress from developing. As a result of that, the stressful person gets to have their own way. They are allowed to do as they please. Everyone scatters and lets them have things the way they want them to be. This is a very vital discovery. It places the person in a position to control environment by the development of an unpleasant disposition. They get their own way. They are catered to. No one wishes to argue with them. And where this type of situation exists, a very important series of lessons is lost. When someone acts unpleasantly and we decide to simply retire from the situation, the result is the unpleasant person has lost an important possibility for personal growth. They would have been far better off if those around them had stood up on their feet and opposed an hysterical attitude. But it becomes unpleasant, it becomes tedious, and sometimes even expensive. So rather than to face this emergency, the individual is given into until their disposition is properly spoiled, and they will carry this through life. Wherever an emergency arises, they will seek to get their own way by an exhibition of unpleasant disposition. Now, we all have a tendency to degree to cultivate this situation. We have a feeling, for example, that if we talk louder than the other person, we are proving something. That we win a debate by some emotional outburst. Actually, we win nothing. But there are a great many people who mistake emotion for rationality and believe that they win by an exhibition of temper rather than by solid judgment or knowledge. If you find this tendency arising in yourself, if you find the inclination to bluff, to try to force your way through by intensifying emotion, you are probably subject to a modified form of hysterical reaction. Actually, wherever the human being wishes to make the most out of life, it is very necessary to be able to accept that which is not always agreeable. We must be able to face disagreement with calmness and with kindness and attentiveness. We are here to learn and not to overwhelm someone else by the intensities of our reactions. We are not well off if we permit any form of stress to compensate for lack of judgment. Everyone must try to judge the proper values of things. And to do this, we should be relaxed, we should be self-contained and poised, and we should be very attentive to information that may not particularly please us, but which may be very important for our well-being. Actually, most persons have a tendency to provide emotional outbursts as a result of some form of emotional frustration or disturbance in a related field. The individual who has no outlets, therefore, is very apt to develop hysterical tendencies. If we have good physical activities, if we are engaged in sports, in tennis, or in golf, or things of that nature, or we have interesting hobbies and avocational outlets, if we are able to keep the mind more or less concerned with constructive activities, there is very much less likelihood that we will become emotionally distressed. One of the avenues which shows this up clearly is the field of sports. The loser has to be a good sport. And if the loser loses his disposition and becomes unpleasant, he is a double loser. He not only has lost the sport, but he has lost control of himself. We take it for granted in a field of sport that the winner and the loser should be still friends, should recognize the circumstances, and not permit disappointment, chagrin, or mortification to interfere with a pleasant acceptance of loss. We have to learn this. Now, when we go out in the world where sports are not exactly as pleasant as they are on a tennis court or in a swimming pool, we also have to learn to be good sports. If we are a good sport, we will not have very much of danger of the hysterical reaction. It is wounded ego sometimes that causes it. It is the sense of defeatism, of chagrin, and actually it is resentment against a victorious rival. In life also, it can be a resentment against the failure to get what we want when we want it. A resentment that we are not able to keep up with other people. All kinds of chagrin can result in the gradual building up of this tendency to a reaction of hysterical proportions. Now, we have to study the human body a little bit in this and the factors that are behind it. Behind the physical body of the individual, there is what is called an energy field. This is more or less a magnetic zone. It is an energy-distributing area that corresponds with the maintenance of our vital resources. This field of vital energy is not actually a being in itself. It is this structure within our invisible natures which results in the manifestation of most of the physical body functions. It is responsible for the circulation of the blood, and it also maintains the magnetic content of the blood. It contains a nutritional factor. And if allowed to function in its normal way, this magnetic field is the basis of reasonable health. It is this field which supports and nourishes the body, just as food nourishes the physical body. Its magnetic field nourishes functions. It nourishes the invisible causes and sources of our visible activities. It is the basis of our feeling well or our feeling ill. And anything that interferes with the distribution of energy through the body is almost certainly going to affect health and disposition at the same time. The magnetic field is almost entirely responsible for what we call disposition. It has to do with the attitudes that result from adequate or inadequate distribution of energy resources. The individual who is tired all the time doesn't have as good a disposition as one who feels better. The person who is constantly depleted in energies is likely to develop negative attitudes, is apt to become pessimistic, and lose control of the nervous functions of the body. If, therefore, we find a tendency to unusual fatigue, if we find that the body is not supporting us reasonably well, we have a series of possible solutions. One, of course, is nutrition, by means of which we provide the body with certain basic elements and chemicals and materials which it needs for the maintenance of its structure. But the magnetic field of the body makes use of the structure which is supported by nutrition. The magnetic field, more or less, functions through the level of the bodily nutrition. It is not the source of it, but it does use it as a bridge or means of getting into the physical consciousness or disposition of the person. Therefore, the nutritional side, building up physical resources, provides in due time a better field for the manifestation of the magnetic field. This problem of maintaining the magnetic balance is a very intricate one. It is this magnetic field which constantly recharges us and gives us the ability to work and do the things that are necessary. As in the case of an automobile, we put gasoline in the tank, but we still need the electric system. The gasoline in the tank is the nutrition. The electrical system is the magnetic field. Without either, the structure and function of the car is practically impossible. So having this combination in mind, we then have to consider how the magnetic field itself is affected in its function of protecting our health. As we know from the old records and from a great deal of ancient and more modern research, the magnetic field of the human being is a kind of envelope. It is a kind of egg-like structure, invisible, but surrounding the body with a field or aura of energy. This field or aura has a circumference, and that which is within this circumference forms a kind of pool of resource. It gives us the basis of our magnetic nutritional support. Now, this particular field is vulnerable in several ways. Magnetic energy is very largely under the control of various pressure-making mechanisms within us. If, for example, the physical body is allowed to run down, then the flow of magnetic energy into the body is impaired. Now, where an impairment of this kind occurs, we also sometimes have a byproduct that is unpleasant. If the energy cannot flow properly through the body, it may break out in various areas and parts with conditions that are malefic or evil. It may create growths and things of this nature because it cannot function properly through the structure of the body. When the magnetic field is blocked, of course, the immediate reaction is loss of vitality. There is a kind of loss that is not to be compensated for by nutrition alone. The individual tries to eat more, may eat rapid energy foods, particularly carbohydrates, in an effort to regain this sense of well-being. If he is very, very foolish, he will attempt to do it with alcohol. But this, again, only results in further depletion and further destruction of the magnetic resources. Actually, the only way in which the magnetism flowing into the body can be maintained properly is when the channels for its distribution are kept in a healthy condition. Now, these channels react very definitely to attitudes. The physical body basically does not react well if it is not properly maintained. If the laws governing the body are violated, the energy field is not able to come through properly and take care of the person. Also, the emotional nature has an influence on the energy field. The feelings of the individual are also nourished by energy. Our thoughts, our emotions, and our physical functions are energy sustained. And wherever this energy sustenance is disturbed, we are going to have a reaction that gradually extends through all parts of the corporeal structure. The different fields of energy have their rules and laws. And Oriental philosophy has long understood this and tried to make it a part of our normal regimen of conduct. The maintenance of man's nutritional energy, derived directly or indirectly from the sun, derived also less directly but perhaps more empirically from the whole cosmos, the cosmic energy which finally seeps its way into the mechanism of the individual human being, has rules that have to be kept. If these rules are not kept, health will not be maintained. These rules include, mostly, the proper regulation of the processes of assimilation and excretion. The processes that keep the body healthy. The body must have the energy necessary to transmute alchemically nutrition into body strength. It must also have the power and ability to maintain the functions of discarding that which is no longer useful. Otherwise, we come against a problem, that namely, that if there is a blockage in the flow of energy from the sun through the magnetic field by way of the spleen into the body and from the body through the functions of the body, if these processes are disturbed, if this distribution system is damaged, then we begin to add up to problems, difficulties. And we have learned from the study of nature and from the realizations of the wise that the only way in which this flow can be normal is if the person through which it is flowing is normal. Unless the person whose body is under consideration is living in harmony with natural process, we cannot expect these processes to function properly. Now, there are problems here that we can't completely control. We cannot control the pollutions which affect the planet at this time. We cannot control entirely the adulterations of the food products that we eat. We cannot completely control the bad habits which are necessary, apparently, to maintain our economic survival. And we cannot control the endless irritation arising in our relationships with other human beings, either intimately personal or collectively social. So the individual has certain problems, some of which he is not going to be able to completely solve, all of which, however, can be improved. And this improvement really represents a careful estimation of what we must do to retain the rhythm of relationship with natural energy resources. If we break this rhythm, if we disregard it, we are in trouble and always will be. The answer, for the most part, is the one that the hardest for us as average persons to achieve, namely, simple quietude, a sense of non-resistance to fact. About now in our political history, most people are batting their heads against bulwarks that they cannot overcome, and most people are unable to handle facts. They resent them, they downgrade them, they know they're not right, but they also have another fact, that in most cases there is nothing the individual can do about it. Therefore, the main problem with all this difficulty is to retain as far as possible a normal relationship with life. Actually, we have to live with our own relationships. We have to live with the kind of world our minds, emotions, and energies and intensities create for us. And we must keep the pressure low. If we do not keep the pressure low, we are going to have these occasional or sometimes regular outbursts of dispositional violence. We have always had them to some degree, but they are becoming more intensive and are probably best indicated by the violence which is breaking out all over the world. Violence that is represented by murder, by all kinds of crime, by international discords, and by a continuous development of irritations. Today, it is almost impossible to find a country that is not dramatically irritated about something. And it's hard to find an individual who is not irritated about something. Now, irritation is an irritant. It is not a force for good. Any stimulation that seems to come from irritation is false. The individual is therefore gradually undermining himself and deflecting from its proper purposes the energy of the sun upon which he must live. He is therefore taking this energy and abusing it to maintain his grudges rather than using it to develop the resources of his own nature. This philosophy might not be so sound in its applications if we lived here forever. If our physical existence in one life was to extend for 2,000 or 3,000 years, there would be another type of point to consider. But with only a comparatively moderate span of life, the possibility of a solution of the major problems which concern us, this possibility is very slight. Instead of trying to solve them by a head-on collision, the best thing that we can do is to relax and try to plan and devise as rational and intelligent a method of handling these problems as is possible to us. Where we don't know how to do this and where we cannot achieve some form of control over our own reactions, we come to these hysterical outbreaks. We come to the point where we can't take the stress any longer. Something has to give. In politics, this ends in riots, ends in civil war, ends in rebellions. And on another level, it ends in the disruption of our economic, industrial, and even our agricultural systems. Therefore, the reward of violence is hunger, pain, and destruction. And yet violence is so close to the surface in most of us that it takes a certain amount of care and thought to make sure that it doesn't erupt unpleasantly. Now, this is for the problem of hysterical outbreaks. Now let's consider for a moment the other aspect of this problem, and that is hysteria per se. Hysteria as a clinical ailment, as a diagnosable disease, is rather different from the hysterical outbreaks of the individual who lacks self-control. Very often, a serious hysteria represents a psychological problem, and it also can definitely represent a long hereditary pattern, a great deal of hysteria in its pure sense. It is hereditary. It is not necessarily carried forward through the bloodstream, but it is carried downward through the psychological integration of several generations of forebears. Hysteria, therefore, of this type is very often not accompanied by any of the common symptoms that we refer to as hysterical. In a great many cases, hysteria has no visible symbolism of violence. Hysteria may be a complete neurotic withdrawal. The individual may retire completely into themselves and remain isolated. In this case, the general attitude is that the person is licking his wounds. Actually, however, hysteria can be a withdrawal from society. When it is this, it is often the result of a bruise or a struggle or a painful circumstance. Clinical hysteria is probably one of the ailments which has contributed to the monastic way of life. It is the cause of many persons departing from the material world and its activities and retiring into the cloister, or coming into a lonely, isolated life, or going out and living in the wilderness by themselves. One of the problems of hysteria, therefore, is escape through isolation. Now, this escape through isolation does not necessarily mean that the person recognizes that he is directly running away from something. He simply finds that his nervous system, his sensitivities, and his sensibilities are such that almost every material contact hurts him. He finds that instead of being able to cope with things, he is bruised, he is disillusioned, he is disappointed. And as the condition extends itself through his life, it finally can reach the point in which the person is disillusioned in everything, even in himself. This type of complete withdrawal is a very difficult type of ailment to face or to work with, but it is something that has to be considered from a psychological standpoint. Now, this withdrawal, however, may and often is associated with some mechanism that justifies it. Very few people withdrawing from life or wanting to live in an isolated way simply say they don't want to meet people or they do not want to be around people. There is a reason that gradually develops in the psychic integration that makes the thing they do not want to do increasingly difficult for them to do. One of the kinds of problems, therefore, is a development of a whole series of pseudo-ailments, many of which are still diagnosed as major diseases when actually they are hysteria. One type of hysteria, for example, can be a pseudo-heart trouble. Many cases of so-called angina pectoris, which is a painful and dangerous ailment of the heart, is not a heart ailment at all. It is simply a form of hysteria. It is something in which the individual has gradually developed a symbolic mechanism to prove why he cannot do the thing that subconsciously he doesn't want to do. Another type of ailment that comes along in this type of thing is hysterical paralysis. A person may have every symptom of paralysis, and yet it is not a genuine case. It is a case of a person who is trying in one way or another to accomplish a definite purpose, either withdrawal into self or the creation of sympathy on the outside by which the person comes to be catered to or taken care of. As an infant might be. It is therefore a regression into infant dependence. A very good example of one of these cases is a clinical story of a paralyzed person in a wheelchair who had not walked for years, whose Uriah was seated by the side of a swimming pool in a wheelchair when one of her grandchildren fell in the pool. The child could not swim and began to sink and scream for help. The woman, who hadn't walked in years, got to her feet, got into the pool, and swam to the child, brought it on shore, got out of the pool herself, and did not go back to the chair. Yet she had been diagnosed as a hopeless paralytic. This paralysis was therefore a psychic form of hysteria. It was something that gradually developed all of the symptoms of the genuine thing, but which actually did not have any foundation in the legitimate circumstances and conditions associated with paralysis. Now, this has a bearing on another field that is interesting, maybe somewhat controversial, but I think in all fairness to all concerned, we should mention it, namely the problem of faith healing. Now, all faith healing is not working with hysteria. There's no question about that. But there are cases in which faith has produced the release from hysteria. If faith is stronger than fear in a particular case, and the cause is hysteria rather than the actual ailment, it is quite possible for the faith to make the individual have the strength of character to recover from their ailment. The attitude being, of course, that the individual is not recovering by their own effort, but the concept which arises in the mind and consciousness, namely that any person united with God equals a majority, and therefore that the presence of the divine accomplishes a miracle. Now, there are people also who have various recoveries from ordinary ailments. Most doctors are aware of the importance of the bread pill. There is a mass of hypochondria floating around in this world. In the more obvious and simpler forms, we are able to cope with it fairly well. But there comes a time in hysteria in which the ailment arrives at proportions that are very difficult to cope with. This situation is always possible where we have lack of emotional integration and personal control. If, for example, the individual is gradually building character, particularly if they are using some simple but effective self-disciplines and are also determined to devote their lives to useful purposes, the tendency is for nature to step in and help them cure their various hysterias. For example, the person who goes out into the wilderness to live by themselves because the world hurts them, or because they have a feeling that this complete absenteeism from society is a spiritual grace, these people very often just get worse. They cuddle their own hysteria to the end of life and never realize the mistake they are making. If a person with a tendency in this direction would turn around immediately and forget self and dedicate life to the service of that which is in need, if these persons who are unable to stand the pressures of society take on problems or burdens of helping people, of serving, of going out and doing good every day in some practical and simple manner, there is a great probability that their hysteria will be overcome. I know one case in which a man, teacher in a university, was finally required to retire because he developed a very strange stammer. It became a problem of stuttering. He took a number of courses in recovery, gained some benefit from them, but in a short time, the stammering returned. During World War II, there was a shortage of teachers. And this man offered to volunteer to take on the work he had previously done if the class would accept the limitation of speech. He could talk, but it was not fluent, and it was often broken by the stammering. After consideration, the student group, it was not a very large class, it was a highly specialized subject, agreed that it was better to have him than nobody. So they said, all right, we will adjust to him and try to be good students under him. So he started in, and he taught for the best part of 2 years. And after the first month, the stammering began to disappear. And before the term was over, he was speaking perfectly. And he told me, I knew the man, he told me that the reason this change took place was a constantly increasing sense within himself that he had to do better, that he couldn't fail these young people, that he had to get the information across. And by degrees, this determination to accomplish the purpose resulted in a complete correction of what had been diagnosed as an incurable state of affairs. So we note that wherever there is a tendency to a morbid hysteria, where hysteria is an escape mechanism, or where an individual is unable to accomplish what is necessary or has no necessity in life, the first problem is to try and meet this need by a practical commitment of some kind. One problem, of course, that is not generally recognized is the fact that parents, when their children are grown, generally find their lives are less important. They have done their job, which birds have flown and are building homes of their own.